Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
And today is going to be a high-contrast resolution show with divergent personalities. I'm very happy to have on the show today Hella Spare. I hope I'm saying that right. She'll correct me in a moment if I'm not. Formerly Vera. And Hella has written a book, or maybe two. We'll find out more about that. But the amusing thing for me is that I coached at the same club with Hella, and we were on different courts, and it was a pretty dramatically different display of styles there. So we're gonna bring Hella right onto the show here. Hello, Hella, are you there?
I sure am.
Okay, terrific. So yeah, I'm a little out of breath because I ran downstairs and ran back upstairs during the intro there. So how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Bill, and thanks for having me on the show.
Excellent. Excellent. So tell us a little bit about you and where did you grow up?
Yeah, I was born in Denmark and grew up in Denmark, which was a very little country as far as tennis was concerned. And my parents played tennis, and that's how I got started.
Okay. And then what were some of the interesting things about the way you learned tennis?
Well, it's very different from the States. I came from the largest club in Copenhagen, and it was named KB, which is Copenhagen Ball Club. And there were not really tennis pros. That's not really a profession that was very common at that time. So people just kind of played with one another, and it was more of a buddy system where people helped each other. So my parents got me started. Then I would be playing a lot of or spending a lot of time on the wall and just hitting against the wall. And then eventually another girl came and she was hitting on the wall and we would be hitting together on the wall. And then we would hit over the wall back and forth to each other and we couldn't see each other. And we did that for hours and we only had one ball each. So you couldn't hit it too hard because then it went over a fence and we would never find it. So you learned this high, high net. And then one day we looked to the side and there was a tennis court, of course, nice red clay courts. We had about 20 courts at our club. And we said, look, let's go in there. And the net was so short because of the big wall we had been hitting over. So that became just kind of a fun, easy way to play tennis because the net was like so much shorter and our one ball didn't get lost nearly as easily. So that's how we got started.
So I guess that was the opposite of quick start tennis. You had instead of having a 29-inch net, you had a 10-foot net.
Yeah, exactly. And we had, you know, very short background. There's only maybe 5 meters or so between the walls. So it was like a mini drop shot you'd have to hit, you know, over that high wall. So it was quite challenging.
That's interesting. So now, your career as a player, so what was kind of the height of your career and how did you develop along that path? I mean, so take us through, you know, coming up as a teenager and then up into your highest level.
Yeah, I really liked playing tennis. I really liked being on the court. It was like I liked that freedom of being on the court and being alone and then the problem solving. And it was like I felt normal on a tennis court. I didn't quite feel I fit in anywhere else. So I felt really safe. And that was something that, so I would spend hours on the tennis court. And I became a junior champion early on, and we were, my girlfriend and I, we were both champions at our club in two different age groups. So we would just kind of dominate junior tennis as we grew up. Her name was Seuss, and we lived close together. We just spent all our time at the club. And that was a great friendship to have somebody that would just, we had the same desire. And at 16, I went to Germany, and that was, we traveled a lot on vacation times to junior tournaments as a club. And that was a nice thing that, you know, I never did it with my parents. It was always as a club with other players. So parent, not too much parents interfering or anything. It was kind of my thing. And I won the European play courts at 16, which was a big deal because Denmark had not had somebody winning that for years. And so that was kind of my breakthrough as to this could be really good. I can compete besides, you know, out of Denmark as well. And Martina was growing up at the same time. I don't think she played in that tournament because I would have probably not beaten her. But we did play some junior tournaments against each other. And Bjorn Borg and I were very close. We were like 1 week apart in our ages. We had birthdays a week apart. So we grew up together and did a lot of junior tournaments together. So he was kind of like a role model for me because in Denmark we didn't, you know, there wasn't anybody for me to really follow. At that age.
Were the two of you friendly? Did you interact much with her?
With whom?
With Martina.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we were very good friends.
Oh, terrific. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
You know, I remember...
And we have maintained our friendship. We're friends on Facebook, and I've seen her a couple of times. I gave her my book, and she has come to the club at Harbor Point and done some... charity volunteer with the eSurance. So I've seen her a couple of times over the years since I stopped playing.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting phenomenon about change in America that, I mean, I remember her being, you know, the evil Eastern Bloc destroyer of America. And, you know, and it was during the Cold War and everyone was suspicious at all times of Eastern Europeans and all that stuff, and just the whole, you know, watching the evolution of her, you know, friendship with Chris Evert and,
mm-hmm.
and that whole thing, that's just really been that's a snapshot into the change of our society over the years.
Yeah, big time. I mean, we played in Czechoslovakia, and the Danes would come. And there was Czechoslovakia, there was Russia, and we didn't know anything about politics. And Martina would be playing for Czechoslovakia, and then there were the Russians, and there was this awful. The Russians were, you know, controlling the Czechs at that time, and they were kind of like not giving Martina the fair shake at that tournament. So we as Danes, who were all liberated and we thought we were everything and didn't know anything, but we started clapping for the other way to even it out because I think it was all Russian clapping and it was all in the cheering. And then we did the opposite and we were escorted out and were almost sent home to Denmark because we got involved in some kind of a cheering. So that was my early sense of, wow, there's some serious politics going on, you know, outside my little sheltered country of Denmark.
That's,
but she has had to fight a lot, yeah.
Yeah, and good for you. I mean, that's nice to know that you, everyone had that conscience of wanting to even that out. So now, as your career progressed, what were kind of the heights of your career and who were some of the top players that you played? As you were in the pro ranks.
Yeah, I then came to the United States 1 year to play the Orange Bowl, which was still a junior event. And then the second year I came to do that, I was 18 years old, and I just thought I got an opportunity to stay over here. in the States, and I didn't go back to Denmark. And that's when I met Oscar Wegner, actually, and he said that this was just a great opportunity, and he would help me and my girlfriend at that time, Suze, to get on the tour and coach us, and we would help him coach some juniors, and then he would help us coach, help coach us, and he could get us in where we otherwise were lost and didn't know how to really break in on the tour. And so I called home and said, I'm not coming back home to my parents, and I still had half a year of high school left, so that didn't go over very well. But, you know, on the other hand, they had always said, make your own decisions, and, you know, you're mature, and live by your own, you know, you're having the consequences of your decisions. And I said, this is what I want to do, and here's the opportunity. I don't think the opportunity is going to be here in 6 months. This was now. And so I was set out to make it, because I had made that big decision of not coming back home and finish school. So I got started. We did get on the WTA had just kind of formed. The women had the Virginia Slims. I got in on a futures in Florida, and I kind of took a Greyhound bus there. We arrived in the middle of the night. It was just one of those fluke things, and I woke up, had to play the first match in 4 hours, and got to the tennis courts, and I beat this girl, Qingling Chang, who had just come down from the Virginia Slims down to the Futures. So she was seeded one, and I beat her. So that was kind of the ticket in, because there was no ranking at that time. So winning that match, then it was like I thought I had to go back to Florida and the family after that week. And then the tournament director, Vicky Berner, said, so are you know, we'll see you next week. And I said, really? She said, yeah, you're in. So then we got to play the next week. So for 4 weeks in Florida, we played, and that's how the whole starting on the tour happened. And then
wow.
I just followed it. And then, yeah.
That's amazing. You know, and that's what I love about these talks with people is that, you know, we might know a little bit about you, but to find out how it really happened. So now, how did your game evolve? What were some of the things that you were working on, and you know, how did what did Oscar do? What was the most memorable kind of principle that he brought to you?
Yeah, I think what he did, and I didn't realize until I started teaching a lot, and I'm like, that's Oscar's philosophy. You know, it was kind of the thing of tracking the ball with my racket. And just really letting my racket do the work for me. You know, if I remember to hit it out in front and I remember to come from low to high, accelerate, then I had my forehand. And so I think he helped me with that. But he more or less just also made me believe that I could do it. I never really was saying, I have a bad backhand, I need to work on that. I didn't know how to grow my game. It was almost like it is what it is, and it will grow as I just keep practicing. So as far as coaching, I didn't have a consistent somebody saying, you need to work on this or you need to work on that. So I was more into maybe covering for my weaknesses and trying to just live with what I had and hoping that that would get better with time. And had I known, you know, of course, now that you can come in with a weaker shot and work on it and get it better, I would have spent a lot more time on, let's say, hitting backhands and trying to come over a backhand and not always slicing it. But I was just into thinking that here I am with this package, and if I just keep doing what I'm doing, I'll get better, and I hope that somebody I play against is not going to get as better as fast. I didn't really understand the concept of developing a stroke or developing something. It's kind of like if I didn't have it, I probably would never have it, was my thought process at the time.
Yeah. So do you have any memories of really unusual or sort of funny, comical things that had happened on the tour?
I mean, there were a lot of funny things. I don't have any Yeah, I don't have anything that really stands out. I mean, I had fantastic, great moments by just traveling and funny things that happened with, I mean, funny and not funny. I mean, you lose all your belongings. You get robbed at the tennis court with all your portrait money, and what do you do in a foreign country? Go ahead.
So where were you when that happened?
That was in Italy. That was in Rome at a qualifying for the Italian Open, and I had my suitcases and everything on the court because I had not had any time to get to the hotel before we had just arrived, which, again, is, of course, poor preparation, but that's how we traveled in those days. And off the court, while I was on the court, with people hanging on the fences because I was playing in Italian, when I was done with the court, everything from my travel purse or bag was gone. And later on, they found the passport thrown in a bush down the path. So then I had to, you know, get American Express, and I had to get all that done. Thank God for, again, the tournament director and some people there. They helped me and put me up, and it became a great experience. But, you know, I was 18 years old or 19 years old, and it wasn't easy, but we managed, and we, of course, had some good, fun laughs afterwards about that.
And that's an interesting thing, too, because how would that ever happen today? I mean, it's really interesting sometimes how these moments of adversity build into your character, but then, you know, if you'd had a helicopter parent and an entourage, that would have never happened, and you wouldn't have had that, had to figure out how to get through that.
Right.
I have a big problem with the coddling of people. So anyway, yeah, I'm jumping all over you. So what were you going to say?
Well, the other thing is that comes to mind, and that will get us maybe to talk about Torben a little bit, Torben Ulrich. I was at Wimbledon 1 year, and this is in the 70s, because that 73 to 78 was when I played Wimbledon. And it was late at night. The sun had just gone down. They were taking down the nets, and that's one way that they make you not play any longer, because they simply remove the nets at Wimbledon overnight. And then I walk out in the back on the court, and there are two people moving out there and playing, and I'm thinking, how can that be? And I come closer, and there's Torben Ulrich playing with Scott Borowiak, and they have their rackets, and they're playing this incredible match. And they're running for drop shots, and they're running down lobs, and they're grunting, and they're bending, and they're stretching, and they are balanced. And it was like music or poetry in motion type thing. And I just stood there for 15, 20 minutes, and here was my idol, Torben, yet another thing that I had never seen before, that he told me, he showed me, you don't need a tennis ball to play. You just need imagination and how to create a ball, a point. And they knew when it was a drop shot because they had read it, and it was so fun to watch. And that's just another great story that I don't know if you'll see today, but it was really memorable.
Well, so wait, was it Jeff Borowiak? Because I thought that Torben and Jeff spent the considerable time.
Jeff
okay,
Borowiak.
Yeah, Scott's brother, and Scott may have been around at the time. But, yeah, I've heard a lot of stories. A friend of mine, you know Maurice Newman? Maurice was talking about a time where he got the hit with Jeff and Torben, and there was one tennis ball, and they showed him the one tennis ball, and it was pretty clear, don't miss. So it's probably the most, he said it was the most pressure he'd ever felt on a tennis court was hitting with Jeff and Torben. With one ball.
Yeah. No, I learned a lot of discipline from Torben, and I had a huge size poster, full size poster of him in my bedroom growing up, and he was my idol. And I would travel by train to go out club in Hillerup, H-I-K was that club, and I would travel at midnight going out to hit balls with him, and he would be serving him at me at the net. He would want me to serve as hard as I could at him at the net and for reflex volleys. And we would just be pounding it at each other. And then by 2 a.m. I would be back home again and go to school. Yeah, it was fun. He's still in my life today. So it's been a great journey with Torben.
Yeah, you know, like we were talking about, I want to reach out to him because I'm hearing about him a lot lately. I was with Doug King on Wednesday, and Doug was telling a story about a time where there was a conference, and every coach at the end gave their final words of advice, and one guy said, keep your eye on the ball, and the other guy said, attack the short ball, and the other guy said, you're only as good as your second serve. And Torben spoke last and said, hit the ball and remember that there's great suffering in the world. And
yeah.
So that left an indelible impression on Doug because it put it all in perspective.
Right.
So, Torben kind of do that with you too? Did he work with you and kind of get you to see it as, hey, this is a game and a privilege?
Not as much in my early years because I wasn't into seeing that. I wasn't old enough to see that. So I just took it as a tennis. And I wish I had known that what he taught me was also lessons for life. I just took it in. But later on, when I started to get some insights and I got into Buddhism just like he was. So again, I found him through some mutual teachers that we had. I'm like, oh, this is what Torben has been doing all along. And that thing about playing one point at a time or just like being in the present moment and taking everything in, it all started to make sense once I saw the spiritual side of life and trying to implement that into tennis, into life, and making it all one. But it took many years before that came together for me.
Yeah, that's awesome. And, you know, I've kind of branched out into life/success coaching. So I'm also now starting to ask tennis pros, what is one of the life lessons that you learn from tennis that then you convey and you turn and you make that a life lesson that you teach?
That's what comes to mind there is OPAT or ODAT, which is one point at a time or one day at a time. I live in, like Billie Jean would say, live in the now or we only have the now, play in the now, and I didn't get it. And With my change of heart and change of mind over the years and growing up and having, through suffering actually, getting to these great places of depth, then I saw the preciousness of the present moment. And again, you have to be present to win. You have to be present to play your best tennis. So how do we get in that zone? How do we get into that present state of mind, which comes sometimes naturally as a tennis player, as you kind of luckily roll into it, but how do you fabricate that, and how do you get to that or strive to be in that present moment? And I think you can't worry about the future, you can't be mad about the past, the now, or the present, and all those life lessons turn into tennis lessons. And if you know it in tennis, try to apply it in life. So I kind of had known it how to do it in tennis, but I never had applied it to my life. So when I saw it's just so all together, it became a little easier because then I almost would know how to let go or how to just be and not worry about the future or be mad about something like the last point missed. It's gone. I can't do anything about it. So how do you let go of that? Not by shaking your head and banging your racket, that just keeps it fuel to it. How do you let it go? So there are tools in breathing, and you can use your eyes, your walk, and your posture. And I think Jim Lehrer, of all people, the first sports psychologist I ever came across, had a big part in teaching me how to deal with the 20 seconds in between the points. You know, his 16 seconds deal was, and that's been fantastic. And Kathy Toon has taken that further in the Game Face book that she has. And she just gave a talk on at my club last week or the week before, and it was well attended, and it was all on the mental game. And she's saying, how come we spend, you know, 90% of our effort on the tennis court physically when 90% is mental? We all hear that all the time. How come we don't work more on the mental part?
Yes. So let's backtrack for a second, because I think it's really key, and Oscar, when I interviewed him, he also keyed in on this, that people carry their past forward, and then they have limiting thoughts that come from that. And then, you know, and then when they're so worried about the outcome of today's match affects my future in a certain way, and then they put excessive pressure on themselves because today's outcome is tomorrow's future, kind of a thing. So I have one of those cute little sayings, you know, where it says, where it goes, yesterday is the past, right, and that's history, and tomorrow is the future, and that's a mystery. Today is a gift, and that's why it's called the present.
Exactly. I love that one, too. When I first heard that, I was like, yes, I love that.
and then there's so much genius to that staying in the moment. You know, there was an interesting thing that came up. I get these emails, and some of them are, and they're all about kind of success and life, you know, and how to tackle it. And they were talking about how people whose brain waves are operating at about 19 cycles a minute are doing genius work. And people whose brains are operating at 21 cycles are nervous, upset, and worried. And so it comes down to slowing down by 9%.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, they also say man's biggest fear is sitting alone in a room with oneself. You know, people would rather stand on a big stage and make a fool of themselves behind a microphone at times rather than be left alone in a room, and then what do?
Exactly. Or they'll leave their family at 8 o'clock on Thursday and go charcoal Thursday shopping. So let's shift away from that. I decided to call it charcoal Thursday because it's not quite Black Friday. So now in terms of your coaching, you know, obviously Torben and Oscar, very influential there. Have there been some other coaches who've influenced you and you draw things from their principles?
Yeah, as a player, my coach, Gordon Smith, was very close with Rosie Casals and thus Billie Jean King. So I would get a lot of their philosophy through Gordon, and that became kind of my philosophy. So it kind of was more, I drew from my experience as a player, and I taught what I saw. So I'm very much what I saw and what I feel and how to do it. So I can't teach a stroke I can't produce, let's say. So I've never really taught saying, here's a two-handed backhand and this is how you do it, because I don't really have a two-handed backhand. So I can do a two-handed backhand, but that's not my forte per se. I will teach the strokes that each player I make each player bring out the tennis player in them, and then I will take it from there. Instead of teaching everybody a one particular stroke, I like to just take each player and see what comes natural to them, and then make their game what that person should be. So that involves strategy, that involves intent, movement, and then the hitting the ball is kind of like the easiest part once you get the movement and the timing, and they need to have fun hitting the ball. So that's kind of my coaching, is just see if I can make a tennis player out of anybody that walks on the court with what they have.
Yeah. You know, I think I actually differ in terms of the teaching what I don't do thing, because what I do, you know, especially because John Yandell was talking about four different styles of two-handed backhand. And so I hit a one-hander, but I think it's really fun that I can teach somebody to hit a two-hander that's better than mine very shortly.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's a funny moment. I tell them, hey, I look at my horrible two-handed backhand. Yours is better. Excellent. You know, so that's also a lot of fun because you sometimes have to do that because the person differs in style.
Oh, yeah. And I think I start all juniors with two hands just because it's easy. I wish I'd have two hands because that left hand is such a nice help to do it. No, I love seeing the kids having and then teaching them one hand afterwards to a slice and approach shot and stuff. So I think you need to have both in today's game.
Yeah, there was a trick question going out there. So you can quiz people on this. How many players out of the top 100 have a one-handed backhand? And the answer is 100, because
right.
They all have the slice. So,
right.
You know, everybody's got a one-handed backhand. If you don't, then you're just not going to be slicing at all.
Right. Or volleying. Nobody has a two-handed volley.
Yeah, exactly. So, all right. Now, what's next? Okay, your book. Now, have you written one book, or have you written any more since that?
No, it's just kind of had different prints, but I have. It's in the third print. It's Dynamite Doubles, Play
yeah.
Winning Tennis Today, and that just came from a lot of teaching of doubles, and I wanted to make a video, you know, some 20 years ago, and then it was like, well, where's your script? And I'm, oh, okay. So then I had to write a script, and then it might as well be a book. And that has been, you know, that's just kind of like the cornerstone of what I teach right now. The strategy in doubles to me is so intriguing. And I've given talks on Dynamite Doubles. I go to clubs. I've done it with USPTA, and I teach it all the time, and it's evolving, too. It's not a system that's cut in stone. It actually has changed as we have, you know, as I keep teaching it. But that has been really, really fun, and I think I've helped, you know, also other teaching pros, giving them material in how to be a consistent doubles coach, because so many things vary and happen so fast in doubles that if you don't have, in my opinion, something like a map or framework to hang on to, how do you tell people when to come to net? How do you know when to stay back and not get caught in no man's land if you don't have something to hang on to? So that's
right.
been a lot of fun, and I feel good about having put that out. And now I'm doing a lot of video clips that's coming to explain the book, and that's what I wanted to do originally. So that's finally coming out now, too.
Yeah, and I've been very much influenced by your book, and it's a very large chunk about in regard to what I teach in doubles. And I think it's really interesting that the Marin connection of you and Steve Turdo, and between your two books, I would say that completes probably 90% at least of what I've learned about doubles and teach. What are some of kind of the unconventional things that are in your book, if you want to allude to them? I mean, I think people should get the book, but, you know, if you can kind of bait them with some great snippets.
Right. In doubles, the question is typically who takes the lob, who takes the middle ball. Those are kind of the questions that I see people not knowing, and they constantly have like one player taking the lob that shouldn't take it, or one player going for the middle ball, or nobody goes for the middle ball, and the winner is right down the middle. And it comes from people, two players being side by side. So in the system of Dynamite Doubles, you're always staggered. Just like you would be in a two-person volleyball game, you never see them side by side. You have a blocker up at the net and another player who's cross-court, a little bit more staggered back, who's more defensively minded. So we have an aggressive terminator, I call it, kind of a more aggressive player and one that is more defensive. And it all depends on where the ball is on the court, because it is a ball game. So the ball is flexible and it varies where it is, and you as a player have to constantly play in a zone that where you're able to defend whatever shot comes back. So that, I would say, is you're never side by side, always staggered, and you're always trying to defend 100% of your court when opponents hit the ball. How nice would it be that you can get to every ball that is hit? At least get to it. Then we can decide afterwards how you're going to get it over the net. But in doubles, there's always that question, how did that ball get between us? Or how come nobody got that? And people looking at each other and saying, I need a new partner. Instead, here it is, where did it come from? Yeah, where did the ball come from? And once we know who it came from, we now know whose ball it was. So that it answers that trick question.
Well, and that's incredibly empowering because then it's not a big mystery, you know. Oh, I have no idea why we lost that point or why we won it. You know, when people really can latch on to why did they win or lose a point, then they can also prevent it or, you know, prevent a loss or, you know, increase mm-hmm. their chance of victory. You know,
They can accept it so much faster and let go and come back to the next point. It's just an easier process. There's no blaming. There's no doubt creeping in. And those are usually the factors that make you play the lousy next point. So it's like an easy, oh, yeah, that was mine. You shake it off and you say, next time I'll get that. That brings hope. That brings new, hope and excitement. And then we can move on to the next point. So I think that just eliminates that long lingering blaming game that it ends up being.
Yeah, and furthermore, when people play sound, you know, tactically, then really only a perfect shot can beat them. And there's no tactic that defends a perfect shot. So
exactly.
So then you say, wow, that's just a tremendous play from my opponent, and then you don't have to feel like
right.
you lost because you know that they won on a miraculous shot, and it increases your
right.
appreciation. And so I have a funny story about the techniques, the tactics that you teach, making grown men cry. So I was using your tactics, and I was really playing a really strong center field in doubles with a guy who was 85 years old, and he hadn't won a set in over 10 years at the club. But, you know, and everybody kind of took their turns losing with this guy. And so, you know, on the senior set, it was like, okay, it was just a matter of could you win a couple of games with them on your side?
Right.
So I jumped to the court, and I'm like, I'm hopeful that we're going to do pretty well. And so this guy, the 85-year-old guy, and I beat a couple of 60-year-old guys. And, you know, I just told him, you know, whatever you know, just lob, and if you can get it over that guy, then they have to hit it towards me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so we worked that, and we won the set, and then this 85-year-old man broke down crying and thanked me for a week.
Wow.
I mean, it was just such a wonderful moment, you know. And,
yeah.
And there's no way I would have been able to do it except for, you know, using tactics that I learned from your book. So
that's great. Those are great moments and makes it all so worthwhile. You know, there's so many great moments like this in tennis, I think, that we get as teachers, teaching pros.
Yeah. You know, and it goes beyond, you know, winning a national championship or all the so-called ambitious things we do. Sometimes it's that match with the 85-year-old that's really
Well, some of my greatest moments as a coach is when the rackets are still in the bag and we're on the court talking and we never even get on the court. We're still by the bench and we're still by the net, and an hour and a half later, one of us is having goosebumps on their arms and the other one is crying, and it's just one deeper level of trust and intimacy, and it was tennis that started the conversation, but it just got so much deeper, and all of a sudden somebody breaking down and then freeing themselves up to maybe go out and hit some tennis balls. And it's just wonderful moments. It isn't a big championship that I remember when I've from my coaching times. It's all those times where it just took its own life because we both had the guts and the willingness and the trust to take it a step deeper. And it's to better oneself, right? I mean, you're there to take a lesson to better yourself, whether it be mentally or in your heart or physically with a tennis racket and a ball. So those are precious moments that are very, very, they just sit with me, and I get very grateful for that.
And, you know, that's interesting. And I think that that's part of the reason why people like you end up teaching in places where you are, because you're with people that really truly appreciate that. I mean, I was really kind of blown away by my short time at that club, how interested people were in other people, because not every club's like that. But I remember being at your book party, and how all these, you know, retired Harvard professors and, you know, San Francisco socialites were so incredibly interested in me and everything about me. And I was like, it really struck me that that's what makes these people so successful, is they're so interested in other people.
That's a good point.
How to be better.
That's a good point. Yeah, I've been there since 87, and it is amazing. It's like my second home, and we are really fortunate in it's a good place. So that's nice to hear, Bill.
Well, I think, and it goes back to your point about being in the present moment, because it's really easy to go to something and say, oh, I don't really want to be there, so I'm not going to be there. I'm not going to take interest in the people who are there. I'm just going to check my phone and fiddle around and try to get out of here as quick as possible. But every meeting with people is a chance to better ourselves or them. So, I mean, I guess to apply that to tennis, I mean, the lessons that we teach ought to be more than just how to play tennis a little bit better today.
Yeah. I mean, taking the time to be present and listening is huge. And then the time goes so fast. You try to fiddle and diddle with your phone and make time go by so you can get out of there. How fast is time moving, right? It's the slowest, slowest, slowest. It never happens, it seems like. And you are present for 2, 3, 4 lessons in a row. It's as if you've only hit the same ball. Goes back to the Torben thing, you know. And I just think it's so ironic that, you know, make haste slowly. The more present you are, the fastest time seems to go. But also how there is no time.
Right.
And
right.
I have never taught the same lesson twice, which is also why I think I can still do it, because it's always new and fresh, and I love that about tennis. It has a way of just bringing me to the now, and everything else stands still. You know, I'm not worried about family, mortgage, this and that. It's all about just showing up to be present, because that's how my tennis is going to be the best. And then I think that just, you know, it's very, I don't know, it's just very refreshing, and I don't get tired of it, and it seems like, you know, people really, it's a great way of connecting with people. We have that gift,
okay,
you know.
So let's shift gears here, and let's talk to coaches and parents and players, because, you know, they're all listening today, and so let's say somebody's, you know, very ambitious to become a great player. So what advice do you give to coaches to develop, you know, be a part of the development of a great player?
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, I think the player has to have a certain, has to have the drive themselves. It cannot be, I can't be caring more about his tennis or her tennis than that player. The parents can't be caring more than the player. That thing about the work you want to put into it and how badly you want it has to be coming from the player first. Once they have the desire and the willingness to do whatever it takes and have that kind of hunger, I think there's great potential. Then it's almost like the sky is the limit. If they don't have it and it's more pushed from the parents, he has great talent, but he's lazy, we can try and nudge him around. You know, I can try and nudge the player to it, but I don't want to spend more energy on creating the willingness than the player has. I mean, it that has to go hand in hand, or just kind of, because that's how I was. So you can't make a player. I think the player has to want to make themselves and then have the help from the coaches and the parents to support, which is often stay out of the way and let the player do it and let the player say, I need help with this. If I say, you need help with this, they have a way of saying, well, that isn't working and making me wrong. That becomes this little bit of they become in their own way. They kind of get in their own way and use a blame mechanism. If they come and say, I lost this match because every time I hit a slice backhand, it went out, or let's work on that. Now you're ready to hear that. But if I say, now it's time to do that, just because today was Wednesday and it was on my agenda, I don't think I'm helping that person much. So I like to get
I have a story that supports that. And it's kind of amusing because we can sometimes get our egos bruised by this stuff if we let it, if our ego's in it that much. I had a young man who's a really solid volleyer, and he hit a two-handed backhand. He also had switched to a one-handed backhand and hit some terrific slice on it. So once that kind of came about, then I was recommending to him that he begin to serve in volley some. So, you know, for over the course of a couple of months, I had mentioned to him not only you should try a one-handed backhand, but and then later he came to me and said, oh, Coach, I'm gonna change to a one-handed backhand. But it was like he had no recollection that I'd ever mentioned that to him.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I went on to, you know, talking to him about, you know, serving and volleying some, and he, you know, ignored me for a long, long time. And then it became his idea, and he said to me, you know, right before I go to North Coast Section playoffs here, I'm going to become a serve and volleyer. I'm like, okay, very good. And I said, yeah, this is great because I've been hounding you for, you know, a couple of months on this. And he just gave me this blank look.
Right.
Like, what are you talking about? And so, hey, you know, it doesn't bother me, but it is really interesting how much of that exists in the person's mind. And so we kind of have to cooperate with that.
Yeah. No, it's a fascinating thing, and we have a big influence on players, but we can really also get in the way of it. Parents can get in the way of it. We see it all the time, and I just think as a parent to try and just be supportive, thumbs up, you know, all the things. You're not their coach per se, but really just be supportive and show that I love you, even if you win or lose, because I got mixed up in thinking winning, then I got approval, losing, then I was a loser. And it was really hard because I thought winning was everything and not really understanding I'm going to learn to lose a lot to get better. You know, so much early on in my career that winning I associated with being accepted and being in. So then when I started losing more, it was kind of like, I need to get out of here because this is not a friendly environment. And I wish I had had a lot more of it's just the process. It's playing this point that's the most beautiful thing you have right now. And how do you perform the best? By being at peace of mind and being in a good happy mood and not being angry and work on those things. So if you see a lot of anger and temper, it's like I think we got to work with some of that because that will get in the way, you know, of kids. But it's the joy bringing the joy.
Anger is good. I like a little bit of anger. Too much anger.
Yeah, sure you do, Bill.
Well, no. Okay, here's a perfect example. I keep bringing this up. This my listeners are going to get tired of this one, but. Federer, Agassi, final in the final, one set apiece. Agassi's up a break and looking for all the world like he's going to win the third set. They play a fantastic point, long points. Agassi wins it in New York. The crowd's going crazy, right? I'm pretty sure most people see this. But Federer got very, very upset. He did the Klingon death cry. And then what did he do? Then he calmed down, and then he beat Agassi in four sets.
Right.
I mean, he was outplayed in that third set, but he found a way to win it anyway.
Yeah, so he used it to his head. He turned it around because he was able to calm down after that.
Yes.
Right?
So that's
why I say
a little bit of anger is okay, but it has to be channeled and directed, and you can't jet fuel. You know, you can let it fuel you for a short period of time, but if you use too much, you're going to burn out.
Yeah, and we can work with it. I think it's okay. It's a nice motivator at times, but it doesn't define you. I have anger that kind of passes through me, but I am not angry. So if you can distinguish between those two, it's a much different relationship you have with it. It's just a temporary emotion that's flowing through your body, and it will pass just like anything else. And learning that is just kind of, then you don't have a whole match carrying you through that. And so those are just things that I have found helps. You know, everything is temporary. So, and it isn't good or bad, but we need to work with it. If young kids have issues where they start the blaming or start because the parents have pushed them up to being so great players early on, where the kids are running the show, that's not all too healthy. I think we got to be where they still go home and have the respect for the parents, and the parents run the household. So be careful, you know, letting the kids run the show too much. We see that a lot.
Yeah. Now, okay, so we're talking to the good parents, because the good parents are listening, and they care, and they are teachable. So what advice is there for when you're out there and you encounter the bad parents and the bad families? How can we start to, and you know, I'm going to call them bad. It's a very subjective judgment, I know. I'm sorry about that. But how can we start to reach out and influence those people that aren't open-minded enough to really start to see the light? How can we do that?
You know, I don't know how easy it is to change people. You know, it's pretty difficult to change myself. So I always think that just by attraction, showing how it's done, and then the ones that are, so you call them bad, but the ones who are a little out of line, or they haven't quite found the balance, it will play out. I don't think you can influence them. When they are ready to learn, they will either learn by watching how the successful ones are doing it, or they will find a place in their life where it isn't working anymore and it will take care of itself. They will either leave the game or they will seek help. But until they're ready to change, we're not going to be able to change them at all. I have had no success changing people when they're not ready. Until they're ready, I live by attraction rather than promotion philosophy. So I think just by good examples, and you might swing some people over on that side, and not giving it too much energy that it's good or bad. It's just, this is how we do it. Just do the next right thing, and don't give it too much. Look, they're bad, they're this. Just ignore that. Ignore it and move on, and it will take care of itself.
Well, you know, I agree with you that if they're not open-minded, that it's not going to happen. But, you know, one thing I see is I see families and kids who are, you know, they're conscientious. They want to do it right. But they've been learning under a system where the coach is teaching them to take advantage of every possible little form of gamesmanship that they can in order to win a match. So you know, I'm likely to have a very polite conversation with the parent and say to them, oh, by the way, you know, you're not supposed to speak between first and second serve. So if your opponent has missed first serve, you should not say to yourself, come on, before the second serve, because that's a hindrance. You know, there's no one to talk to. So you ought not, you can't, point has started, there's no talking. But that's something that's been creeping into the game. And you see these little trends of bad sportsmanship that come up. I had a situation where I noticed that kids were starting to return the ball back to a player with a hard hit shot while the player wasn't looking. So, you know, it's between points and they're giving the ball back, but their way of giving it back is at a 50-mile-an-hour forehand as kind of an intimidation play. And I'm not a big fan of that. That's something that was a trend a couple of years ago. Well, I saw one player hit the ball really hard, 2 feet within my player's head. And, I got a little angry about that.
No, and of course I think when you coach, you also coach the parents, and if you're going to take them to tournaments, they're going to start doing that. I think we have to talk to the parents. We have to say and talk to the kids, like it's psychology. It's kind of have a group meeting and say to the kids, what is helpful to you when you're out there? What kind of things are you looking for? And then the parents, well, how do you think you want to help the kid? And what would be helpful when the kid is done? Would you like him to come over to you right away? Do you want to give him 15 minutes where he's on his own? And you kind of come up with a plan that everybody is agreeing on. But I see people tiptoeing around and sometimes not knowing what to do. And I just think that's maybe the place of the coach to sit down and say, okay, we're going to a tournament and this is how it's going to be. And we're going to I'll talk with the kid just before the match. That's not your place as a parent, and then afterwards, maybe who should talk to the kid first after he gets his 10-15 minutes of just finding, especially if he lost, you know, what does he need before he's ready for feedback he doesn't just go in the car and sulk. No, we have to learn to accept and deal with that loss or that win in a manner that is that looks like a good sportsman out there.
Exactly.
So you can be a winner on and off the court.
So we have 2 minutes left here. So if there were some key points from this conversation that you'd like to highlight, what do you think the top two or three things are that we talked about during this time?
Well, it seems like the theme of it, we keep coming back to about how to be in the present moment. You really can't go wrong with that. So being...
Yeah.
Present and being able to take people to the present moment, I think, is just the challenge of every relationship that we have. And as tennis coaches, we have great opportunities for that, because to play tennis, you have to be present to perform your best possible tennis for that, you know, best possible game.
Exactly. Okay.
Okay.
Okay, so what would be another thing, what would be another takeaway from this?
The importance of influential people in your life that you can kind of draw from, such as I had Torben, I had Oscar, I had Jim Lehrer, I have also Pancho Segura, Martina was in my life as a how to do it, because we were same age, Bjorn Borg. So I learn a lot from watching other people, and they have all been, I've taken part of them into my life. So I think it's important to have a mentor or a teacher in anything you do.
Absolutely. Hey, that's terrific. Thank you so much for coming on the show. How can people reach out to you in order to find out about your book and or maybe, you know, arrange to have you come to their club or school?
Thanks, Bill. The name of the book is Dynamite Doubles, Play Winning Tennis Today. And I have a website that's dynamitedoubles, dynamitedoubles.com. So www.dynamitedoubles.com, and all my information is there, and I'll sign books and send them. I will come to your club, and then I teach at Scott Valley Swimming and Tennis Club in Mill Valley, and that's where I've been for 26 years now.
And that's in Marin County.
Yes, in Mill Valley.
All right. Hey, Ella, so nice to talk to you and get to know you a little bit better, and it was great to see you at the conference there as well. So,
thank
anyway,
you, Bill.
We'll be in touch.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be in touch.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Take care.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.
All right, everybody. Wow, that was fun. Ella is great, and you know, you'd love to be a fly on the wall and see me coaching next to her, because it's a completely different thing. But I was always amazed at how quiet she was on the court, because I'm the exact opposite. Anyway, so check out her website, definitely. And I think there's hope that we're going to possibly get Torben Ulrich on the show coming up soon. So that's it for today, and it's time for me to leave you with
opinions stated by various contributors to the UR Tennis Network and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network. Participants are encouraged to use their own discernments and draw their own conclusions. All information, products, and services offered by the UR Tennis Network are for personal use only. The UR Tennis Network does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of information contained within the network. Any products or services provided for should be used solely for entertainment purposes. We emphasize the idea of keeping an open mind and not construing the products, services, or data as factual.